Jesus said in Matthew 5 that true disciples of his were the light of the world, that it was their calling to be salt and light in a very dark and tasteless world. Daniel experienced that in Babylon. He was taken away at about 15 years of age and hauled off to one of the most corrupt, vile countries in history, where he stood out as salt and light. Paul did the same thing in Athens. John the Baptist did the same thing in Israel. It's always been a privilege, hasn't it, to proclaim hope to the hopeless, to be able to represent the good news of the gospel. And you do understand that our culture is hopeless. What other explanation could there be for such vile behavior that goes on so often? Peter, in describing this, writing to the folks in 1 Peter who had been scattered to foreign lands because of persecution, says this in 1 Peter 3:13, "Who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you are blessed. And do not fear their intimidation and do not be troubled." Then this great statement, "But sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence." He goes on to say, "And keep a good conscience, so that in the thing in which you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ will be put to shame. For it is better, if God should will it so, that you would suffer for doing what is right rather than for doing what is wrong." I love that text of Scripture because it tells us that we need to have Jesus set apart, holy in our hearts, reverenced, followed, revered, loved as the Lord of our life. And when that is in place, we can make a defense, a Greek word apologia. We have an apologetic, we have an answer, we have reasoned arguments to pass on to those who are watching, those who have no hope but see that we do have hope. And they look at us and they begin to ask questions because we are living such hope-filled, positive lives that we can minister to them and tell them about the gospel of Jesus Christ. And we always do that, as he mentions here, with gentleness, that's strength under control. We don't blast them, we don't overwhelm them, we don't mock them, we don't ridicule them. We, with gentleness and reverence, that's a word for fear, respect, awe. Why would I have reverence for a person who disagrees with me on serious issues of life and morality? Because they're created in what? God's image. They are sacred. They are precious. They're a gift. They're not our enemies. Our enemy is not flesh and blood. We do have an enemy, and he's a liar. And he leads people astray. And it's our privilege to bring them back to the truth. So we make a respectful, loving, gracious appeal to people based on reasoned biblical truth, even philosophical truth, medical truth, constitutional truth. We reach out to people with the truth so they don't have to go march for something that's not right. And we then trust the Spirit of God to work in their hearts. We always get to make a defense of our hope. But I believe right now and over the next several months, we have a unique opportunity to do so because of what is going on in the abortion debate. This is the hot topic in our culture, have you noticed? And it's going to get more and more intense in the weeks and months to come because of this focus on the potential overthrow of Roe versus Wade, something we have prayed for now for the last 49 years, as we've waited upon the Lord for this kind of a moment And it's going to have a limited effect, and we're going to have to be ready for the next steps beyond that. But it appears that there's a good chance it could be overthrown. And people are going to be discussing this and debating this everywhere. You're going to hear conversations about this coming up at school and in the workplace and in your neighborhood. It's going to be on talk radio. It's going to be on the news. There's going to be parades and marches for and against. We've already seen it where people are being encouraged by our current government to break federal law and go picket in front of the houses of Supreme Court justices. Did you know that's a violation of federal law, being encouraged by government authority? That's how strongly people feel about these issues. It's not just a theoretical thing to folks. This is real. And by the numbers of folks that have had an abortion or are thinking about an abortion, this affects virtually everybody you know. It's a very emotional thing. It's a very guttural thing. This is something that people feel so deeply, and some hurt profoundly because they did have an abortion years ago, and now they're wrestling through the implications. And if what I share with you is true, they've got things to wrestle through. And all I can say is, and we'll keep saying it, forgiveness is available. You hear what I just said? There is forgiveness through Jesus Christ. People can be forgiven and reconciled and can go on and to have very fruitful lives because of the gospel. So if you're not aware of why we're talking about this morning, it's because of a leaked draft of a Supreme Court decision that's not final, but a draft written by one of the Supreme Court justices was leaked to the media as he was writing the opinion for the majority that essentially would overturn Roe versus Wade and Casey. It was based on a court decision over the thing Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. In 2018, the state of Mississippi passed a law called the Gestational Age Act, which would have prohibited nearly all abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. It would have limited exceptions for fetal abnormalities and medical emergencies. Well, in 2018, after that law was passed, the Jackson Women's Health Organization challenged the constitutionality of that law. It has been accepted by the Supreme Court after the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Mississippi and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit held that the law was unconstitutional. So it made it to the Supreme Court. Now, those courts did their conclusion based on precedent from Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, both of which said that abortion was legal pre-viability, viability being an age where supposedly a child could survive outside the womb with proper medical care. So that would be the foundation for the lower court arguments. As a result, the state of Mississippi filed and said, then we want you to overthrow Roe and Casey so that that precedent has nothing to do with the reality of what we're doing. And that's what has gotten to the Supreme Court. In response to this leaked draft, you might have also seen just even last week in our news, a bill dubbed the Women's Health Protection Act was put to vote in the Senate that would have made it a right, a federal right to have abortion. So understand, that would have then become the law of the land, that abortion was a legal right for all people, all women. Now, when you think about that, that has massive implications. It would have struck down not only that, because they claimed, and by the way, this same bill, almost identical bill, they tried to pass it 3 months ago. It was defeated 48-46. It lost this time 51-49. One Democrat joined the Republicans voting against it. But it needed 60 votes to pass. They knew it wouldn't pass. They put it forth for a vote so they could make a statement to the nation where every senator stands on the issue of abortion. That was the point. They stated they knew it wouldn't pass. They just wanted everybody to have it in the media. This is who voted for and this is voted against, so that it could impact the midterm elections. They claimed it would only codify Roe, but that is misleading. Because written into that bill took it way beyond Roe, and it would have taken away every law passed by every state that limited abortion whatsoever. In other words, it was an unlimited abortion bill allowing abortion up to the moment of birth in all cases. Now, do you understand that only 6% of Americans believe that that should be the case? So our government authorities were supposedly representing us, but they actually represented only 6% of the population in trying to push forth this bill. Some pro-choice people are claiming that if the Supreme Court overturns Roe, the next thing the conservatives will do is declare interracial marriage unconstitutional. Now, get that reasoning. If you take away the precedent of Roe versus Wade, we're going to go back to pre-Civil War era. We're going to have slavery again. We're going to have no interracial marriage, and on and on and on and on. You know there's some real problems with that? Justice Clarence Thomas, one of the prominent conservatives on the court, is in an interracial marriage. Why would he ever allow something that ludicrous? But this is how deeply people feel about these issues. The emotions are so high that they begin throwing out rhetoric that is totally nonsensical in order to win people over to their side. By the way, we have our program this summer for the kids called Summer Adventure. We chose the material months ago before this became an issue. The material is called Zoomerang from Answers in Genesis. It's all about the sanctity of human life, highlighting how every person is created in the image of God. We did not do that intentionally. It was not intended to be antagonistic. It's just truth that we believe and we want to pass on to our children. Now, some people will contend that our pro-life arguments are all religious. They would say that this was really driven by the Catholic Church and we're just following along and all of our arguments are religious. We have no real moral argument. We have no real constitutional argument. We have no real scientific argument. We have no real philosophical argument. You guys just go to the Bible and then it's all religion and we don't even want to hear it. But let me say something to that thing. When you get into a discussion with people about that, and this is kind of an apologetic morning, I'm going to spend more time focusing on the things that are non-religious here so that you can get into conversations with people and show that you are aware of the issues and you have intelligent, cogent answers to the issues at hand. First of all, calling something religious in a debate is called a category error. That would be similar to saying, how tall is the number three? They don't relate. You see, it does not matter what the source of your argument is, it matters the validity of the argument. If you can't reason with the argument, if you have no answer for the argument, you throw out statements like that's religious, hoping it'll go away, rather than dealing with the argument itself. So if someone throws that at you, that is not the case. Secondly, at the base of the pro-choice argument is their own metaphysical assumptions. They have all kinds of assumptions that they bring in that are religious in nature. It's not the worship of the God that we know, it's more of a humanistic belief system. But there is a metaphysical base for what they believe about the nature of the unborn. Thirdly, pro-life advocates utilize arguments that are not overtly religious, as you will see this morning. So I want to take just a quick look this morning at four major areas that you can utilize in a debate with others on this issue so that you have an apologetic that is sensible, that is current, and that you can stand firm with, yet with reverence and with grace. The first area I want to look at is the constitutional argument. What is legal? Let me give you a little background on the historical legal side of this. Roe versus Wade was in 1973. It ruled that a woman had a constitutional right to abortion. Now, this was because a law in Texas was being challenged that was limiting abortion, and they were saying that that law was unconstitutional. That's what brought it to the case. By the way, the woman who was the object of this thing is now a very outspoken pro-life person. She was the one that was utilized in the lawsuit. She now disagrees with that lawsuit. So over time, somebody helped win her over with reason and love and respect, with truth. Roe versus Wade was based on an implied right to personal privacy that they claim emanates from the 9th and 14th Amendments. So the court determined that a woman's, quote, right to privacy extends to her ability to make a choice regarding her health and her body. The implication of that was, and what they applied it to was, as she has the right to choose to become pregnant, she has the right to end that pregnancy. So you catch this? Supposedly, the 9th and 14th Amendments to the Constitution give you this right to privacy, although this is hotly debated. And that right to privacy in a woman's case allows her to terminate her pregnancy. Let me ask you a question, though. What about the constitutional right of the unborn? What about their privacy? What about their ability to choose what they do with their own body? These are serious questions. And of course, we're going to get into the reasoning behind that now. In a 7-2 vote in Roe versus Wade, the court said that the Constitution does not define a fetus as a person, but defines it as a potential life. So that thing forming inside of you is just fetal material that might become a person. It has the potential to become a person, but it's not a person yet. The 14th Amendment, they say, guarantees protections and rights to individuals, but does not include the unborn. Roe then stipulated that the government does have a voice in the situation with children and with the unborn, but it's a limited voice. And so Roe versus Wade stipulated 3 trimesters of pregnancy and how much control the government had in each of those 3. In the first trimester, the government had no say whatsoever. Whatever the woman wanted to do, that was fine. In the second trimester, if the government had certain involvement with elements pertaining to the health of the woman, etc., they might regulate an abortion. During the third trimester, they said that the state had the highest level of involvement because they could promote abortion to promote the state's interest in the potential life of the fetus, except where abortion is necessary to preserve the woman's life or, here's the key word, health. So first trimester government, you can't do a thing. If they want to have a baby, if they want to have an abortion, they can. Second trimester, you've got limited involvement and you can discuss it based on issues. Third trimester, now you have a big say, unless it pertains to the woman's health. On that same day, another Supreme Court case was decided called Doe versus Bolton. It ruled that a woman's right to an abortion could not be limited by the state if abortion was sought for, here's a key word, reasons of maternal health. Now, that is such a broad statement that it opens up Pandora's box. When you look into what they meant by that, the court defined health as, quote, all factors, physical, emotional, psychological, familial, and the woman's age relevant to the well-being of the patient, unquote. What does that mean? If for any reason the woman feels like this is a problem, she can have an abortion up to the last second of the birth of the child. That's legal in all 50 states. So when you've heard someone say, no, abortion is only legal pre-viability, that's just not true. And they have the support of the Supreme Court in those 2 cases. That was followed up by Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania versus Casey in 1992. Casey abandoned the trimester framework, replacing it with pre- and post-viability tests for constitutionality. By the way, the court case ruled in Roe versus Wade 7-2, by the time they got to this and Roe versus Wade was challenged in this case, the vote was 5-4. So people were already starting to move away from Roe being constitutional, the justices were. Then it moves on beyond that in year 2000 in Stenberg versus Carhart. The court ruled unconstitutional Nebraska's ban on partial birth abortion. Do you know what that is? I hate to even describe it, but it's basically deliver the baby halfway out, leave its head inside, then stick a thing up in and suck its brains out and kill it, then pull out the baby. This is a child that's going to be born that day. And you can go ahead and kill it that way, because as long as part of it's in the womb, it's not born yet. That was determined to be unconstitutional. Wow. Many have said that Roe versus Wade decision was itself unconstitutional because it violated the separation of powers in U.S. government. So you understand we have three branches of government here designed that way by the U.S. way back when, because of the idea that not allowing any one group or people get too much power. So you have the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch. The legislative branch is supposed to write the laws, the executive branch can sign them into law, the judicial branch can decide whether or not they're constitutional. What happened in Roe versus Wade was the Supreme Court in the legislative branch, or in the judicial branch, became the legislative branch. And they wrote a law that they do not have the authority to do constitutionally. And that has been fought now for the last 49 years. And finally, it appears we have some justices that are agreeing with that issue. Ross Douthat, in his he's a political analyst and New York Times columnist, stated in a column on May 7th, 2022, quote, "Roe was not a persuasive constitutional decision, but rather the clearest possible case study in what it looks like when justices legislate from the bench," unquote. And that's exactly what happened. And there's a myriad of articles written by lawyers and legal minds across the nation agreeing with that analysis. But you're going to hear a lot now what's going this, because it looks like the Supreme Court's going to reverse Roe versus Wade and Casey. They're going to hear this word stare decisis. It's a Latin term that refers, let the decision stand, or let precedent be what rules going forward. In other words, what they're going to say is, Roe versus Wade has been the law of the land for the last 49 years. Don't change it. Precedent is on that side. Stare decisis. Leave it alone legally. Well, there's a problem with that. The Supreme Court has overturned their previous decisions 232 times since 1810. Is there a precedent for overthrowing precedent? Yes, there is. And Justice Rehnquist's dissent in Casey, in his dissent of Casey, he wrote, quote, "The court has overruled in whole or part 34 of its previous constitutional decisions in the past 21 years. So even then, when they were wanting to overthrow it, they were saying, we have precedent for overthrowing it. In fact, they have written that the court's top duty is to reverse wrongly decided rulings. Quote, justices take an oath to uphold the Constitution, not the glosses of their predecessors. So if somebody makes a mistake in the past, it is the duty of the Supreme Court to overthrow that mistake and bring in true constitutional law. Now, I want you to take this now with that bigger picture. Are you with me now on where the constitutionality is of Roe versus Wade and abortion? I want to now take you to another related topic, the Endangered Species Act. Have you heard of that? This was an act that was brought forth many years ago. It is deemed constitutional where you are not allowed to harm certain endangered species. You cannot even harass them. In fact, in last year, two men were sent to prison for 7 months for harming or potentially harming sea turtle eggs. Three men in Nevada were imprisoned for jumping into what they thought was a swimming hole. They smashed some endangered pupfish eggs, and one of them spent a year in federal prison for it. Do you know that it's illegal to harass species? In fact, a man who was building a major building project relocated some red-legged frogs to a better location so he could continue his construction project, and he was arrested for it. That law, listen carefully, does not just apply to living endangered species. It applies to them even in the womb. Even the fetal and embryonic stages of sea turtles are protected by federal law. Only human children are considered worthless. Let that sink in. Is there a constitutional argument against abortion if we protect sea turtle eggs? Shouldn't we protect children even more? One argument has been thrown out that humans aren't endangered. Okay, so humans aren't endangered. So does that mean then that because there's a lot of them, we can go ahead and kill them? Where's the moral argument for that? And by the way, if you've got a constitutional right to just get rid of a whole lot of them, then at what age can you get rid of them? Can you go ahead and kill them off when they're young? Can you go ahead and kill them off when they're old? Can you kill them off when they're no longer important to society? Where does that end? This is not a constitutional argument. Justice Alito's leaked draft revealed that the majority of current Supreme Court justices believe that Roe versus Casey was indeed unconstitutional. In his draft, he wrote this: "We hold that Roe and Casey must be overruled. The Constitution makes no reference to abortion, and no such right is implicitly protected by any constitutional provision, including the one on which the defenders of Roe and Casey now chiefly rely, the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. That provision has been held to guarantee some rights that are not mentioned in the Constitution, but any such right must be deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition and implicit in the concept of ordered liberty." And he's saying that's not. He goes on and says this: "Roe was egregiously wrong from the start. Its reasoning was exceptionally weak, and the decision has had damaging consequences. Far from bringing about a national settlement of the abortion issue, Roe and Casey have inflamed debate and deepened division. It is time to heed the Constitution and return the issue of abortion to the people's elected representatives." You hear what he's saying? It's time for the judges to give it back to the legislature. That's what they're there for, is to make the laws. We are not here to make laws. We're here just to determine if the law they passed is legal or not. He goes on to say, "The permissibility of abortion and the limitations upon it are to be resolved, like most important questions in our democracy, by citizens trying to persuade one another and then voting. That is what the Constitution and the rule of law demand." He went on to say on another page, "Roe was on a collision course with the Constitution from the day it was decided, and Casey perpetuated its errors, and the errors do not concern some arcane corner of the law of little importance to the American people. Rather, wielding nothing but raw judicial power, the court usurped the power to address a question of profound moral and social importance that the Constitution unequivocally leaves for the people." So if somebody says to you that there is no constitutional validity for overthrowing Roe versus Wade, they're just simply wrong. And they need to be politely shown there is no constitutional validity for a federal, at least currently federal, abortion permission. Secondly, we have the issue of medical. And if you're going to get in a debate about medical and science, isn't that what we hear all the time? What did we hear all the time about when during the COVID stuff? Okay, so what does medicine say? Pro-choice people are claiming that a woman has a constitutional right to make personal choices pertaining to her own body, and you've seen the slogan, "My body, my choice." But I want to submit to you a medical fact. The unborn is not her body. This is a medical fact. Science has now validated this completely. That has a separate circulatory system, possibly a different blood type, distinct DNA, and 50% of the time a different gender. This is not the woman's body. Follow this: the child could die and the mother live. The mother could die and the child could live. They are two separate entities. The other one just happens to be within the other. It's a temporary resident of the mother host. It will leave on its own as long as it is not prematurely evicted. New Zealand professor A.W. Lilly is known as the father of fetology. Among his many pioneer achievements was the first intrauterine blood transfusion. He stated, quote, "Physiologically, we must accept that the conceptus," that's the technical term for baby or fetus, "is in a very large measure in charge of the pregnancy. Biologically, at no stage can we subscribe to the view that the fetus is a mere appendage of the mother." One of the leading scientists in the world, that's his opinion. Going on top of that, Dr. Peter Nathaniels of Cornell University concurs. He says the unborn's brain sends a message to his own pituitary gland, which in turn stimulates the adrenal cortex to secrete a hormone which stimulates the mother's uterus to contract. Why does a woman go into labor? Because the baby says to. Did you know that? It is the baby that regulates when the baby comes out. Some of them are just in a hurry to get out. Hey, 7 months, I'm coming out. It is not the mother's body. There is another human being inside of them. And this brings us to the most important question in this debate in every category. When you're referring to the unborn, the question is, what is it? What is it? That question changes everything. When you answer that question properly, everything changes. Question, is it human? Is it a person? If it is a human person, it has constitutional protections and a right to life. When does human life begin? The justices in Roe versus Wade admitted they didn't know when life begins. They didn't know if it began at birth, somewhere prior to birth, what was often called quickening, when the mother felt movement, or at conception. They did not know. In fact, opinion of the court written by Supreme Court Justice Blackmun, quote, we need not resolve the difficult question of when life begins. When those trained in the respective disciplines of medicine, philosophy, and theology are unable to arrive at any consensus, the judiciary at this point in the development of man's knowledge is not in a position to speculate as to the answer, unquote. Well, how do you respond to that? This is how Mother Teresa responded. She wrote to the Supreme Court as it was considering petitions relating to this issue. She stated boldly, your opinion in Roe versus Wade stated that you did not need to resolve the difficult question of when life begins. That question is inescapable. If the right to life is an inherent and inalienable right, it must surely obtain wherever human life exists. No one can deny that the unborn child is a distinct being, that it is human, that it is alive. It is unjust, therefore, to deprive the unborn child of its fundamental right to life on the basis of its age, size, or condition of dependency. It was a sad infidelity to America's highest ideals when this court said that it did not matter or could not be determined when the inalienable right to life began for a child in its mother's womb. I applaud that answer. When does life begin? If life does not begin until the fetus is viable or the child is born, then you could argue that the fetus does not have a right to life. But what if life begins at conception, as the Bible says it does? There is no moral justification for abortion since this action kills an innocent person. Dr. Jaime Gordon was a professor of medical genetics and a physician at the Mayo Clinic. He testified that, quote, the question of the beginning of life, when life begins, is no longer a question for theological or philosophical dispute. It is an established scientific fact, unquote. The medical community is convinced human life begins at conception. You can talk to all kinds of people in that field, all over the place, you will find that. So my friend Scott Klusendorf is one of the top pro-life debaters in the world today. He wrote, the science of embryology establishes that from the earliest stages of development, the unborn are distinct, living, and whole human beings. True, they have yet to grow and mature, but they are whole human beings nonetheless. Leading embryology textbooks affirm this. You can go to all the leading embryology textbooks across the land now, and they will all affirm human life begins at conception. Therefore, elective abortion kills a living human fetus. Now get this. That is admitted to even by pro-choice people. They admit, yes, we are killing a living being. Well, if there's no constitutional basis, and if there is no medical scientific basis for abortion being legal, then where do they turn? That takes us to our third area, philosophical. Now, I don't have time to go into all of this because this is such a huge category, but you might remember back in January, I did a two-part series on biblical sexual morality. And in that series, I went back and I identified the historical things that led up to our current mindset that I guess I would just call it the deification of self. This idea that we are the ones who determine everything, everything's relative, it's only what I feel, what I want, what I determine that is what makes me what I am, who I am, when I am, what I am. So go back and listen to those and you can get all the things that built up to that throughout history. But there's a key philosophical question. Given the humanity of the unborn that now even the pro-choice people admit, it's a human, does each and every human being have an equal right to life, or do only some have it in virtue of some characteristic that none of us share equally and which may come and go within the course of our lifetimes? I'll explain that in a minute. That's the philosophical question. If they're human and we're human, are we somehow different than them to such a degree that there's a moral distinction between killing one of us and killing one of them? And that's the philosophical question to wrestle through. And what is it that makes that definition? If you believe that, what is it that you say confers that right that makes one better than the other? Pro-life advocates say there is no morally significant difference between the embryo you once were and the adult you are today that would justify killing you at that earlier stage of development. In other words, it was just a stage of development. It was still you when you were in the womb. Nothing changed when you came out. All of a sudden, you were a different being, a different species, a different something. Were you still human? Well, that's what the Bible would teach. And so they focus on these different issues. And this is a great thing. And I've given you all these notes in the printed notes. There's so much. I gave you 6 pages of different notes on all of these different issues. But there's a difference of size, level of development, environment, and degree of dependency. And because of those, some would say, well, yeah, they're different than we are, so you can kill it. So wait a second, let's take a look at this. What about, and this was put forth by a guy named Stephen Schwartz in his book, Moral Questions of Abortion, this SLED idea, S for size. You were smaller as an embryo, so therefore you can be killed. Okay, is that a problem? What happens after you're born? Can the bigger person kill the smaller person? Because obviously I'm better than you are. Does that make sense? Of course not. So that should not be a distinction that allows you to kill him. Second, what about level of development? Were you less developed as an embryo than you are now? Yes. Were you less developed as a 2-year-old than you were as a teenager? Teenager as an adult? Yes. Does that mean we can start killing teenagers? Parents, don't answer that question. Be gracious. They will get through this stage. No, that does not make a bit of sense that your level of development becomes a reason whereby somebody can kill you. What about your environment? Well, you would say this. If you were in the environment of the womb, now you can be killed because you're inside the woman's body, but you can't be killed once you're outside the womb? Really? Does where you are have any bearing on who or what you are? You can answer me. When you go to McDonald's, do you become a hamburger? No. The environment does not change you. You are human in both environments. Coming down the birth canal a few inches does not make a difference in who you are. What about degree of dependency? Sure. Does the baby in the womb depend on the mother? Absolutely. Does the baby outside of the womb depend on the mother? Do infirmed people depend on others? Do older folks depend on others? At what level does this insanity stop? Because of a degree of dependency? You can go ahead and kill it? This is absurd. Humans are created equal. It's a preamble to our Constitution. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and among these are life, first and foremost. Because if you don't have life, you can't have liberty or the pursuit of happiness. Number 2 and number 3 depend on the first one. You got to be alive to enjoy the other 2. Does that make sense? That's what we say in a preamble to our Constitution. Do we apply that here? See, humans are equal by nature, not function. Nature was conferred at conception. You were a human at conception. So a pro-life syllogism would say this. Premise number one, it is wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being. Premise number two, abortion intentionally kills an innocent human being. Conclusion, abortion is morally wrong. That's pretty simple, isn't it? You can memorize that, can't you? Very simple. It's wrong to intentionally kill an innocent person. Children in the womb are killed. They're killing an innocent person. Therefore, it's wrong. Pro-choice advocates will say, but wait a minute, the unborn are human, but they're not persons. Now, this is the hot topic of debate right now. You are a human, but you're not a person. Personhood is conferred after you're born. At some point, we're not sure. But at some point when you become, they call it self-aware. Peter Singer, who is a bioethicist from Australia and he teaches at universities here in the US, he has written extensively on this from his bioethical position that is neither really truly biological or ethical. But he has written on this and he's at Princeton University. He claims that in order to be a person and to deserve moral consideration, beings must be self-aware and capable of perceiving themselves as individuals through time. So you not only have to be born, you have to be old enough to be aware that you're there, you being aware of your history, your present, and that you have a future. At that point, you become a person. Now, mark my words, what are the implications then? You not only can kill the child in the womb, you can kill the child where? Outside of the womb until somebody determines it's a person. Does he have the right to make that decision? And why does that criteria wax eloquent versus somebody else's idea? What if you have to be a certain height? What if you have to be a certain level of education? What, I mean, you can just go crazy with this. You have opened a Pandora's box. And why should I ever believe for a moment that somebody is a human and not a person? Have you ever met a human that's not a person? This is absurd. They've arbitrarily created two classifications of humans based on self-awareness. What happens if one person has more self-awareness than another person? Can that person kill the other one? Let me ask you a question. Do you have a human nature? When did you get it? At conception. You are a human then. Pro-abortion people have a worldview that's called body-self dualism. This, by the way, this idea that I have a body, but then I have myself, and myself, my intuition, my thoughts, my feelings, my desires, that's the real me trapped inside of this body, which is why I all of a sudden can determine that my gender is fluid. You understand the reasoning? We talked about this in January. You can go back and listen to those messages. That concept is what drives their belief system. But why should we accept that as true? Christians hold into a dualism, but it's a body-soul dualism. And both of those came together in the womb. In the Christian view, the body and soul are fused together. God made the body as part of what it means to reflect his image. And by the way, when Jesus comes back and restores all things, he's also going to restore our what? Our bodies, and reunite it with our soul spirit. So now, having looked at pro-life apologetics constitutionally, medically, and philosophically, are you still with me? All right, so now we're just going to take a brief look at it biblically, because if this argument is, are all of our stuff is just religious, then I've just given you a whole bunch of things you can use to have talks around the water cooler at work with your cohorts, because they need to think this through. They need to have their philosophy challenged. They need to be able to look at truth and realize that is a human being in the womb. And now we're going to see what does the Bible say about it. Now, the same pro-choice advocates who say that our arguments should not be religious then try to attack us and claim we have no religious basis for our beliefs. They would say this, the word abortion appears nowhere in the Bible, so you should be silent where the Bible is silent. That's interesting. The Bible doesn't say a lot of things that we know to be true. For example, does the word Trinity appear anywhere in the Bible? No, but the concept of the Trinity, the truth of the Trinity is taught replete all through its pages. So it's not that word, but the truth is taught there. So the truth about life and when it begins and how it ought to be reverenced is taught in the Bible, even without using the word abortion. To the Jewish people in the first Corinthians, it was undeniable fact that abortion was wrong. They all knew it was wrong. If you know it's wrong, do you need to write about it? No, your entire culture knew that it was wrong, and you practiced that it was wrong. For example, the Sentences of Pseudo-Phocylides is a book of Jewish wisdom written between 50 BC and 50 AD. They state, quote, "A woman should not destroy the unborn babe in her belly, nor after its birth throw it before the dogs and vultures as a prey." In other words, abortion is wrong. The Sibylline oracles included among the wicked two groups. These are wicked: women who produce abortions and unlawfully cast their offspring away, and sorcerers who dispense materials which cause abortions. So the woman who aborts and the abortionist, they're both wicked. The Mishnah, which was the written record of Jewish oral teachings up from the time of Moses on down, in the Mishnah they stated in one of their tractates, "We infer the death penalty for killing an embryo from the text. He who sheds the blood of a man within a man, his blood shall be shed." What is a man within a man? An embryo. So based on biblical text, they were saying all through the centuries, abortion is wrong, and anyone who commits it is worthy of the death penalty. They didn't need to address it. When the Christian church moved out of its Jewish context, it encountered a culture that was aborting people right and left. And all you read historically about the early church was how they were going down and rescuing those babies and bringing them into their own homes and raising them in the fear and admonition of the Lord. They were not engaging in this practice. They knew it was wrong. The Didache, which is the earliest theological treatise after the Bible, states, quote, "You shall not procure an abortion nor destroy a newborn child," end quote. The Epistle of Barnabas in the early second century adds, quote, "Thou shalt love thy neighbor more than your own life. You shall not procure abortion. You shall not commit infanticide." So then why would the pro-choice advocates say that we have no biblical basis for what we believe? Well, I want you to take a quick look at a passage in Exodus 21. And by the way, we've taught on this before, usually around the Sanctity of Human Life Sunday. There's a lot of messages. You can go back and get a lot more biblical content. But I want you to just look at Exodus 21, verses 22 through 25. Now, the pro-choice advocates use a particular translation to make their point. And so here is the ESV. "When men strive together and hit a pregnant woman so that her children come out, but there is no harm, the one who hit her shall surely be fined, as the woman's husband shall impose on him, and he shall pay as the judge determined. But if there is harm, then you shall pay life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth," etc. They interpret the word "come out" to be miscarriage, as some translations have used. But there is an entirely different word for miscarriage than the Hebrew word that's used here. So they would say, a man, they're fighting, they bump into this woman, she has a miscarriage, and if there's no harm... Well, they say, well, a miscarriage, and that can't be referring to the baby. So if there's no further harm to the woman, then you either pay a fine or whatever. But if you hurt the woman, then it's eye for an eye, tooth for tooth. Well, there's a problem with that. That's not what the text says. They claim Flavius Josephus supports that, and they quote him saying some things about that. But the translator who wrote the translation for Josephus wrote this: "The law seems rather to mean that if the infant be killed, though the mother escape, the offender must be put to death, and not only when the mother is killed," as Josephus understood it. What's going on here? Let me read the New American Standard Translation. "If men struggle with each other and strike a woman's child so that she gives birth prematurely, yet there is no injury, he shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him. He shall pay as the judge decides. But if there is any further injury, then you shall appoint life for life, eye for an eye, tooth for tooth," etc. What do you mean? He's talking about if the woman, if all of a sudden the baby comes out. It doesn't refer to whether it's alive or not. At that point, it's just saying because of this fight, the baby comes out early. If there's no harm to the baby, then you pay a fee to the husband as he determines. If there is injury to the baby, you do equal to the person who caused it. In other words, that life is sacred, and anyone who harms a life in the womb is guilty. They must be held guilty. Well, one more text, Genesis 2:7. Then the Lord God formed man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living being. Some people say, since Adam did not become a living being until he could breathe, that therefore a fetus is not a living being until it's born, and you slap them on the bottom and they cry and they start breathing. Is there something wrong with that opinion? President Bill Clinton, who put forth all kinds of pro-abortion things under his tenure, said that he did so because of what his pastor taught him. And his pastor taught him that based on passages like this, that the pro-choice position was perfectly logical and okay. There's two problems with that argument. Number one, Adam was an inanimate object until God breathed into him the breath of life. But we know conclusively that a fetus is animate from the moment of conception. Secondly, the fetus does not start breathing outside the womb. The fetus breathes through amniotic fluid in the womb. It just breathes differently outside of the womb. So to claim that they're not a human until they breathe, they've been breathing for a long, long time. Does that make sense to you? So medically and every otherwise, they're wrong. The Bible is clear. Human life is sacred because we were created in the image of God, Genesis 1, James 3:9. We have intrinsic value because we're human, not functional value because we can do something. Isn't that what we foist on our people all the time? Oh, I love you because you can do this and do this and you do this for me and you love me like I love me. We're getting along. No, no, no. I love you because you are God's special creation. You have intrinsic value, and you always have had, and you always will. We are human persons in the womb. Psalm 139, Jeremiah 1:5, Luke 1:39 through 45. Children are a blessing from the Lord, all of them. How many of them? All of them. The shedding of innocent human blood is forbidden in Scripture. Conclusion, there is no constitutional, medical, philosophical, or biblical support for abortion. So when the opportunity comes up for you to talk to your friends, express to them, why are you pro-life? Because the unborn is a human person. That's the simple answer, isn't it? Or you could just say, what is it? You answer the question, what is it, then we can have a discussion. But if you want to give a longer answer, my friend Scott said this. Here's a one-minute soundbite. I am pro-life because it is wrong to intentionally kill innocent human beings. The science of embryology is clear that from the earliest stages of development, you are a distinct, living, and whole human being. You weren't part of another human being, like skin cells on the back of my hand. You were already a whole living member of the human family, even though you had yet to mature. And there is no essential difference between the embryo you once were and the adult you are today that justifies killing you at that earlier stage of development. Differences of size, level of development, environment, and degree of dependency are not good reasons for saying you could be killed then, but not now. That's a great one-minute answer. When you're interviewed on the news, that's what you say. So what? Two quick conclusions, then we're going to have a special closing song. Number one, abortion is sin. It's sin because it's murder, biblically, constitutionally, medically, philosophically. It's a sin, but Jesus came to pay for how many of our sins? All of them. And forgiveness is free. Jesus and Jesus alone can take away the shame and the guilt. And he always stands ready to do so. So if you've ever had any involvement with that, his grace is available right now and every day. Secondly, I want to challenge you to engage in the pro-life cause. Pray about this. Pray for our Supreme Court. Pray for our governing authorities. Pray for state officials. Right now, California is stating that they're going to make California an abortion haven, sanctuary, so people from other states can come here when it's illegal there. Pray, pray, pray. Our God can do mighty things. Amen? Pray to him. Ask him to intervene. Then train others. Talk about this with your kids. Talk about this with young people. Talk about this in your life groups. Train each other up. Have good reasons to talk about these things. Vote accordingly. Vote against any measure that's going to go the wrong way about the right to life. And then give money and volunteer at Open Arms Pregnancy Clinic. We have one of the best pregnancy centers in the country right here in the San Fernando Valley. It is decidedly evangelistic. And they are doing so many wonderful things. Then give to meet the needs. When somebody says, you know what, I've decided I'm going to keep my child, this is going to be really hard, then love your neighbor and help meet needs. Don't let them go through this alone. Come alongside them, babysit, provide for them. Let's be the church that wraps our arms around people who make right choices. And then finally, be willing to adopt. We're always accused of, you just want those people to have to endure this thing. No, we should be willing to adopt the children that other folks can't take care of. Bring them into a loving Christian home and teach them about Jesus, that they have intrinsic worth, created in God's image, and Jesus came to redeem them and allow them to have a relationship with Him forevermore. We have an opportunity in front of us, folks. We need to seize it, and we need to be ready to give a defense of the hope that's in us with gentleness and reverence. Father, thank you for this time. Our hearts are heavy because of foolish decisions that have led to 63 million deaths over the last 49 years in this country alone. And how we pray, Lord, that you would soon overturn this lunacy. Help us, Lord, to speak on these issues with grace and love. Help us to be able to minister. And Father, if we're wrestling through this still, help us to think deeply about the fact that you love us, every single one of us, so much that you sent your Son. Oh, Father, open our eyes to your love and your grace that's so freely available. We ask in Jesus' name.